swag bag from Sunstone, something that we wanted to make. And we're lucky enough to have one of the authors of one of the books here. We didn't know that Margaret was going to come, so it's like super cool that her book is in your bag. So she's just going to talk about her book for just a minute and give you some information about that.
Basically, what you have is the last thing I did in literary fiction before I started doing race things. I was doing something else, but then I got pulled into race. So that's my last bit of Mormon literary fiction, but it's really strong on the feminine divine. And I think it's a nice little companion to Nylon's book. I hope you all got copies. Nylon gives such practical ideas for how to implement the changes that can be implemented now. My book is based on my sister-in-law who had multiple sclerosis. We turned it into a play at BYU, and the night that it was opening, I got a call that morning from the care center where my sister-in-law was. She had, at that point, she was totally paralyzed and couldn't speak. And the nurse said, "You should come to the care center." And I said, "Is Nancy dying?" And she said, "I'm not actually supposed to talk about that, but we should come to the care center." So we went to the care center. We were with her as she died. And then 4 hours later, we opened the play that really was a tribute to her. My husband had written the notes, whatever they are, the dramaturg's notes, and it was all a tribute to his sister. So the people in the play went to the funeral of the person whose story they had told. This is a fictional piece. I changed her name. And the people in the care center, the people who had taken care of Nancy, went to the play, and people who had come in for the funeral. So it was a beautiful and devastating bit of synchronicity in my life. And it's a book that I really do feel strongly about. It's been taught in Mormon literature classes, but I think it was quite below the radar. So I'm really glad that people have it, and I hope you read it. I think some of the issues with women, it's very strong on gender roles. I'm really glad that you're doing it. My work right now takes me to Africa. We're working on a film. I'm happy to tell you about that if you want to friend me on Facebook or whatever. I'll tell you, we're basically going to be starting the film industry in the DR Congo. And I'm just psyched about it. So you have my name on your book, so feel free to friend me on Facebook.
Thank you, Margaret, and thank you for coming. This was kind of the last minute thing, but we're so lucky. Oh, okay, so we're going to get started with the last speaker, and just a couple notes. We're going to be emailing everyone a survey. You'll get a link to a survey, and I'd really appreciate it if you filled it out. Like, the breakout sessions we just did was an experiment, so if you liked it, you need to let me know, and if you didn't like it, you need to let me know, because we're kind of, changing the formats and updating some of the stuff, so your feedback is really, really critical. So please talk to me. It won't hurt my feelings. I'm going to be really open to feedback. So, okay. We're going to get started with our last speaker of the evening. I'm so glad that she was able to make it. She flew in just for the day, and she's been traveling all over the country. So, we're just really lucky that she's here. Nylon McBain, and I'm sure you've all heard of her, she's making amazing change in the church right now. She's a blogger and columnist at Patheos.com and PowerOfMoms.com. And she has published in Newsweek, Dialogue, Journal of Mormon Thought, Segula, Meridian Magazine, and the font's so small, BustedHalo.com. And she is the author of this new book, Women at Church, and it is doing amazing things. It's, very Orthodox Mormon women reading about issues of women in church for their book clubs, and there are stake firesides built around this, and so I don't think we can underestimate the importance of the work that she's doing. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, the LA Times, and many top publications. And I don't think I was reading my bio for that. That's really awkward. She's amazing. I'm so sorry. She's the author of Women at Church, and she found it. I was like, where's the more? project on this. She founded the Mormon Women Project, which is huge. And if you haven't checked it out, I mean, it is so important to me and so valuable to me as a Mormon woman. She highlights the stories of Mormon women all throughout, and it's very diverse. It's fantastic. So with that really wacky introduction, I hope that stays out of your surveys. Can I end the thing? Thank you, Lindsay. I just want to personally thank Lindsay for the invitation to be here today. I've been thinking about my qualifications for coming and speaking to you as a group, and I think perhaps the best qualification that I have is that I am currently, with the release of this new book, Women at Church, living really at the fulcrum of the various tensions that are currently existing around women at church. And as an illustration of my rather unique position, sort of in the very middle of, passionate dialogues and heightened emotions around real lived experiences that create the universes of our individual experiences and form our opinions so completely. I'll just share this little anecdote from my trip to Dallas last week, where I gave a women's meeting on the importance of storytelling. And it wasn't overtly about the book, it was about more my involvement with the Mormon Women Project, which, as Lindsay mentioned, is a digital collection of interviews with LDS women from around the world. And as I've been doing that project for the past 5 years, I've interviewed almost 300 Mormon women, and I've developed a lot of opinions about the effects that stories have on us, and I've collected a lot of data about the impact that stories have on us to help us expand our empathetic stance towards our brothers and sisters in the gospel. And that was the subject of my talk last week. And as we opened it up to comments, one of the first comments, after what I thought was a very eloquent tribute to the power of storytelling, was a woman who shared her reasons for joining the Ordained Women movement. And apparently I had the gall to actually let her share her story to the end and actually honor it and entertain it as part of our conversation, and a cadre of women actually stood up and walked out. So, if you choose to walk out on me today, please know that all I ask is that you wave goodbye to me on the way out so I know you're not just going to the bathroom. I can take it. And that is what is very interesting about the position that I am in right now, specifically with a nonprofit organization, the Mormon Women Project, and with a book that I hope really aids in this exercise of bringing us together as a single community. And I think I'll go into some reasons later on why I think that this can be a lonely place to be, but it's also an extremely rewarding place to be, because I feel in my own convictions that several things have prepared me to be in this unique position. One of those things, of course, being an unusual background, is being raised member of the church in New York City. And this was in the 70s and 80s, before, the Manhattan Ward sort of became Utah East, and where people had to be very deliberate about coming to the city. It wasn't just a place you ended up after college for young Mormons. And so for me, there were real experiences growing up in New York of Zion-like community. We were small, we were deliberate, we were brought together in the middle of this bustling city, and found real sense of family and of haven in coming together in those very diverse contexts that had all brought us there. And I remember in particular one experience at a youth conference when I was about 15 years old,
And I was full of righteous fire. I loved the gospel. I loved the experiences I was having as a youth in the church. And we were taken up to a YMCA camp, sort of near the Catskill Mountains, with the youth from several other states. And we performed a series of activities that are probably common at youth events across the church. This particular one, it was in February, and we were tramping through the snow. I remember in particular that our leaders had created sort of distressed hymn books for us to carry around to various stations around the camp. And when we got to a station, we would stop and we would sing a hymn from our little distressed, Xerox copies of some of the pioneer hymns. And one activity in particular, I remember, involved being given an Oreo cookie. And at that point, we'd been tramping around in the snow for quite some time and were hungry. We stopped and we took off our gloves and we started eating these Oreo cookies, only to discover that it had been toothpaste. It was toothpaste in the middle of the Oreo cookie. It had replaced the cream. And we were taught about this very vivid lesson of the adversary, his flaxen cords leading us down into hell through these deceptions, such as, yummy treats. And the Sunday morning after youth conference, we had a testimony meeting, as is common in youth activities. And I will never forget the feeling that I had in that testimony meeting. It was, for me as a 15-year-old girl, an only child of separated parents growing up in the middle of Manhattan, very literally a little slice of heaven. And I turned to my best friend who was sitting next to me, and I said, "I think there are angels with us." And she said, "Yeah, this must be what heaven's like." And I share that story because I've referred to it often in the intervening years as almost a North Star for what resonated with me in my personal circumstance as a Zion moment. And I'm not taking it personally. Thank you. I see your phone. Even though I've had moments with my family that are sort of blessedly released from celestial cares, I think that few communal efforts have ever reached the same plane for me, where unity trumps all. But what that experience gave to me is the knowledge that it is possible. I know it is real. And that knowledge drives much of the work that I do today in fostering a little glimpse of that same community in the church. It's also forced me to ask myself, what was it about that experience? What are the ingredients of an experience like that that helped make up a Zion, if not a Zion community, then at least a Zion moment? And I thought a lot about the idea of the physical gathering that occurred in the early days of the church. The quest for Zion has dramatically shifted from the 19th century call to have people gather to Utah from around the globe. And at the church's beginnings, of course, physical threats demanded a physical response. There was a gathering of bodies, there was a building up of walls, and there was a congregating in a specific place, almost with military precision and with military motives. Right? And we're still feeling the reverberations of that today in the focusing of the church members in Utah. But the reality of the 20th and 21st centuries have demanded instead a different kind of gathering. And that's a gathering of minds and hearts to defend against unseen challenges, competing ideologies, and emotional assailants. It's a virtual gathering in a virtual world. And what I think is fascinating about this virtual gathering is that we are witnesses to it as well as participants in it. And I think we each have had experiences over the past 5 or 10 years or however many years you have been active online, whether as a bystander or as an active participant in conversations about the church online, to see us as a community working out what it means to have our cell towers be more important than the actual physical gathering in the way that we create Zion for our people. And in looking at this idea of, you know, what is necessary for a Zion moment to occur, I, of course, also look at the idea of the family. And specifically the idea that in the LDS Church, we worship geographically. And I think that this is so fascinating. You know, it may be a vestige of our physical gathering, but it's a principle that's held throughout the global growth of the church. And that I think we underestimate how impactful it is and how unique it is to our community to worship with geographically linked congregants. What are the implications of worshiping with those who are geographically linked to us? Some of this was brought home to me a couple weeks ago. My family and I, just, you know, to give my girls a little bit of a broader experience, attended a Baptist church in Salt Lake City, Calvary Baptist Church. It was a phenomenal experience. But at the beginning of the services, there were some announcements, as are typical in our church as well. And the pastor and his deacons made announcements about other Baptist churches in the area. And even in the tenor of the announcements, it was very clear that those other churches have very different orientations. They have different social goals. They have different causes that they're getting behind. They also have variations in the way that they actually baptize and induce new members, which was especially apparent that day because this was actually one of the Sundays where they were baptizing people to become members of that particular Calvary Baptist Church when we were attending. And my girls, my daughters, the oldest of whom is 11, actually turned to me and noticed this. And they said, why are they talking about these other churches as if they're different churches and not just sort of branches of this same community? And we explained this concept to them, and it really came back to me that this idea of geographical worship forces us into communities that are like families because they are not chosen. We do not pick up and align ourselves with different levels of orthodoxy depending on the leader of the congregation, depending on the ideologies of those who are choosing to attend there as well. And that's extremely unique. Even in the other global organizations that don't have actual denominations within them, there is a fluidity of worship that is staunchly not a part of our structure. And so what does that do? It creates some tensions, right? Because like in a family, we are required to not only be committed to our diversity as a group, but we're also committed to being loyal to each other. And I think that that is what we really have been struggling with and wrestling with in our virtual gathering. I'd like to tell a story that I think helps us unpack a little bit more of this idea of our modern-day Zion and what that might mean for us as a very diverse, broad-ranging group of people around the world. In 2007, a journalist with the Washington Post named Gene Weingarten documented an experiment. And this documentation, his recording of this experiment, was so astute and so powerful and so uncomfortable that it actually won him a Pulitzer Prize. And the experiment that he reported on was the playing, performing of perhaps the most famous American violinist, Joshua Bell, in the L'Enfant train station in Washington, D.C. Some of you may be familiar with this. It's got a lot of press coverage. But on April 8, 2007, Joshua Bell took his 1713 Stradivarius violin and he stood with a baseball cap on and his violin case open in the L'Enfant station for 43 minutes and played through some of the great repertoire in violin music. This experiment was of particular interest to me because I come from a musical family, and I come from a classically musical family. My mother was an opera singer. I didn't know who the Beatles were until I was probably 12. And I was trained to hear and to understand what made good music, good classical music. It's something that is just part of my education as a child and as part of my training in what is beautiful and what conveys a sense of beauty to me personally. It was because of the choices of my parents and because of their professions that was reverberating in my home all the time that I was growing up. So the journalist, Gene Weingarten, explained the experiment this way. He said, Joshua Bell's performance was arranged as an experiment in context, perception, and priorities. The question was, in a banal setting, at an inconvenient time, would beauty transcend? And you may be able to guess what happened. There were 1,097 people that passed through the L'Enfant station in those 43 minutes. And there's very compelling video footage of this incident on YouTube. And if you're interested, I encourage you to go look it up. But, of course, everybody wants to know, well, how many people stopped? Out of 1,097 people, 7 stopped. And 23 gave money for a total of $32. And even though there was no demographic consistency in those 7 people or those 23 people who gave money, there was one group that always stopped, and that was children. And I think for me, you know, the lesson of this story, taking a violinist who makes probably tens of thousands of dollars playing in the finest concert halls in the world, and transplanting him into such a banal setting, as Weingarten called it, was an exercise in context and proved that context matters. Can we still hear the beauty of something like a Bach chaconne on a 1713 Stradivarius by the best violinist in the world when we've taken it out of that context in which we have been trained culturally to recognize it as such? And of course, for me, I like to think that I was one of those 7 people who stopped, because I have received so much training. What exactly is it that's being conveyed apart from all of the context? But I don't know if I would have been. Would I have recognized Joshua Bell? I don't know. And sometimes I've made the parallel with this experiment to, of course, to us in the gospel and in the church. I think we're very adept in the church at separating out the gospel from the culture. We talk about that a lot, the doctrine and the culture, or sometimes it's principles versus practice. Those are familiar terms with us. And for many of us, myself included, they're a kind of lifeline to keep us going, to search, to be able to hear and recognize those beautiful parts of the gospel that are resonant, no matter whether we're in a train station or in a concert hall. But sometimes we do find ourselves responding to the context more than perhaps the beauty of the gospel. And this is understandable. The institutional church itself supports the idea that context matters. Think, for instance, about our full-time missionaries. You know, the choice of clothing, the choice of hairstyle, right? The choice of their behavior all lend themselves to establishing a context for a friendly, open conversation with a person who they are targeting. I mean, there would be no other reason for the church to demand these things if they didn't believe that the setting, the context, allowed possible investigators to hear the beauty of the gospel and to hear the whisperings of the Spirit more easily. So this is not an idea that I think, you know, we need to convince any particularly Orthodox church members of. But I think it is something that we all need to investigate for ourselves. Can we hear the beauty of the gospel through a context that may not be amenable to what we're trained to hear it in? Can we separate those out? And in the women's space that I work in particular, I think it's really this conversation that is so near and dear to my heart personally. This idea of creating a context, creating an experiential model that allows our women to feel the whisperings of the Holy Ghost and to recognize the beauty of the gospel more consistently and with more impact. And, you know, that is really at the heart of my work. And some say it's naive. Some say that just changing the context isn't going to make a difference. And they may be right. But at the same time, I have trust in that, the beauty of that music. That if we can create an experience that allows that music to ring through, that will touch each one of our hearts, and that we will be able to come together and surround the truth of that music, whether it be in a train station or whether it be in a concert hall. We will recognize the truth of that music together, and that is what will bring us together. There is a tension that comes from that conversation, of course. There are those of us who were raised, such as I was, I think, to be very easily able to separate doctrine from culture. Growing up in New York, the culture of the church was very exotic. It was almost appealing to me. I never had any of the foods we talked about this morning. Or this afternoon. So when I did, it seemed like a homecoming to me. But for other people, the idea of the church culture really dominated their entire way that they were raised, right? It was a parenting philosophy. It was a culinary philosophy. It was everything. And so it could, at some point, seem oppressive. And so you're bringing these two groups together, and there is a tension. And that's where I personally love to exist. And that's where I might encourage you to love to exist and to find joy and to find fun, if it's possible, and to find some satisfaction in enjoying, in existing and conversing in that middle ground, where we can understand where each person is coming from because their experience is their universe, and we can get to know them through their story. And we can understand the context in which they are listening to the beauty of the gospel, but we can also bring our own story to that mix. I'm skeptical of a Zion that doesn't have these passionate conversations. And I think the scriptures back me up on that. You know, we have a divine principle around opposition. And I think that, you know, we underestimate the importance of that principle when we are talking about the tension between agency and obedience. But I think that is actually one of the most beautiful concepts and one of the things that keeps me tethered to the gospel. The Mormon Women Project, the nonprofit that I have run, is actually a study in this tension. It's a study in how women choose to make unique decisions and follow unique paths in their own lives while still being true to the commandments of the gospel and to the requests that the Lord has made of them. And what I've seen blossom in the study of women that I've done over the past 5 years is this model of this middle ground that embraces a both and paradigm rather than an either or paradigm. It allows women to move from the extremes where they say, I either have to be completely obedient or else I have to completely honor my agency at the expense of all else. And it allows them a place to say, I can be both of these things. I can hold these truths in my hand simultaneously, and I can weigh them with respect for both, honoring both as truths, but also understanding that in that tension is where change comes. It's a natural law, right? The opposition in all things is a natural physical law as well as a spiritual law. It's what creates wind. It's the force by which our beautiful canyons are created, the water against the hard rock. It is the protons and the neutrons and the electrons working together to keep forces in check. And it's the same with our spiritual development. The tension between those opposites crafts a diamond that is worthy of being returned to live with Heavenly Father and Heavenly Mother. And that, I think, is what I hope the Mormon Women Project is studying. And that is what I hope we can bring more into the dialogue that we have about the context in which we are worshiping and the context in which we are hearing the whisperings of the Holy Ghost and the context in which we are appreciating the beauty of the gospel. There are tensions in families. Again, returning to the idea of our worship being reminiscent of a family. There are also contexts that allow us to transcend those tensions and allow us to enjoy the beauty of what we have together. In my family, we are focused very much on this idea of transcending tension through context. And what I mean is we create shared experiences together so that my children learn that although they are very different, we have unifying experiences that bring us together. Some people call these things traditions, and I think we each can testify to the power of traditions within Mormon worship to make us feel tethered to that community. We do that in our families too. That is context building, right? We have shared memories. We have a shared repository of experiences that link us back together, that increase our loyalty to one another, even though we may each be diverse. For me, it's been very meaningful to see that push and pull of my children's individual identities pushing against the shared experiences that we have in common as a family. Because I am an only child, and I didn't have those experiences growing up with siblings. When I first became a mother, I thought it was very scary to see my children fighting with each other. I thought it was the end of the world. I thought, they were going to grow up and all they were going to remember was the Lego fights and the fights over, clothes. We're into that now. But my husband, who's from a family of five, has helped me understand and has helped create those experiences for our family, where loyalty trumps those divisions. And it's been extremely moving for me to see my girls, night and day, different from each other, come to their defense, come to each other's defense in the playground, or call each other their best friends to their other friends, reference their sisters as their best friends. My youngest just refers to the two older ones as the sisters and refuses to do anything without the sisters. And of course, when they get together, the sisters, there is fighting. And it's been fascinating to see them work this out and to see this childlike devotion to each other despite the differences of personality and the arguments that they get into so frequently. It's been an extremely moving experience for me, and one of the great lessons that I've had as a parent in the difference between diversity and disunity. Diversity is also a divine principle. I think it's the manifestation of those opposites working against each other, those tensions crafting something beautiful. We know that diversity is a principle that the Lord has used to create beauty and variety on this earth for our pleasure. We need look no farther than the fact that every single one of us has unique DNA. My husband works in the DNA business, and the variety and beauty of Heavenly Father's creatures, not only human, is just it's a recurring testimony to the divine principle of diversity. And yet, on the other hand, we are commanded to be one. And if you are not one, you are not mine. And Yet again, another tension, another paradox that we are asked to hold in our hands. And what is the link between those two? What is the link that turns diversity, what purifies diversity and turns it into union, I think, is loyalty. It's what I see in my girls, what I'm trying to foster in my daughters. And it's what I see in our very best moments as members of the church. Without loyalty, it does turn into disunity. It turns into fractionalization. It turns on each one of us turning against the other. It turns into sister against sister and brother against brother. And it is at the very foundation of a very rot that can permeate every one of us as members of the church if we do not first put our loyalty before anything else. My efforts in the women's space is to expand the context in which we hear the beauty of the gospel, especially for those for whom the context is the gospel. And my understanding of this viewpoint of the context being the truth, the context being the gospel, has really matured and has really expanded over the years of working with women. I think because I was so adept at separating the two, separating the culture, separating the context from the beauty of the gospel, I kind of assumed everybody could do that or would do that. And it's been fascinating to me to see the pillars on which some members have built their testimonies. Even just yesterday, with the announcement that the church educational system will now hire mothers of small children. They will be paid for their job in the seminaries and institutes. We posted this news, and it was an article from the Deseret News on the Mormon Women Project Facebook page. And lo and behold, there were some responses in the comments of people saying, you know, I can't get behind this. It's a commandment that women not be employed by CES. And I thought, how fascinating, how utterly fascinating that for some members in our family today, there is an absolute conflation of rules and of governance and of this culture, policies being so entirely conflated with that beautiful music that we are all striving to hear. These men and women are also members of our community. They are also members of our family. And what do we do about that? From the point of view of the Mormon Women Project, we foster that feeling of loyalty by honoring their story as much as the story of the woman who shouts hooray and says, finally, about time. And we partly do that through the power of storytelling. We partly validate each woman's lived experience as her universe, because there is a physiological and undeniable response when we share our stories with each other. Unlike any response we get when we share data, any response we get when we share a theoretical story or the story of somebody we knew back when, there is an undeniable release of dopamine. There are undeniable changes in brainwave patterns when we share our personal stories. And I believe that it's through the sharing of those personal stories that we will be able to create that context that fosters unity. It won't just be a context where the gospel is off playing in the corner and some of us may miss it, and some of us may walk on by, and some of us may stop. It's through that shared experience and those shared stories that we will create that context of loyalty, which above and beyond all else, I believe, is the foundation for a virtual and modern-day Zion. There's a story in the Book of Mormon that is one of my absolute favorites. And I'd like to share it with you As an example, I think of one of the best episodes in the Book of Mormon for illustrating loyalty. And it is the story of the people who follow the priest Alma, the priest of King Noah, Alma, who ends up being Alma the Elder. But we read about this group of people following the priest Alma into the wilderness to escape the wicked King Noah. The group gathers at the waters of Mormon to hear Alma preach the truth he himself has just learned and follow Alma's example of being baptized. Alma teaches them that repentance and redemption and faith on the Lord, and they rejoice in learning the truth. And we learn so much about this particular group of people. We learn that they are desirous to come into the fold of God and to be called his people, and are willing to bear one another's burdens, that they may be light, yea, and are willing to mourn with those that mourn, yea, and comfort those that stand in need of comfort. Their commitment to and understanding of each other was so sincere that it was the desire of their hearts to support each other through life's darkest moments. And I don't for one moment believe that each one of those people that followed King Noah was of exact ideological persuasion as the other. I can't imagine that they all came from the same socioeconomic demographic in King Noah's court. Some of them may have been lowly members of the community. Some of them may have been other members of Noah's court and more well off. But what we know about them, what enabled them to found this impactful Zionistic community in the Book of Mormon, is their willingness to be loyal to each other, to share each other's burdens, to mourn with them, not to think that everything's perfect together, not to all wear the same clothes, not to eat all the same things, not to agree only on a few specific points of ideology that they could all get behind. No, it was to mourn with each other and to share each other's burdens, to share each other's stories, to tell their stories, I think. And it was the desire of their hearts to support each other. That, for me, is Zion. It's the connection that comes from knowing there's a place for us in each other's hearts. It's not nodding heads in agreement with every statement uttered at church on Sunday, but it is loyalty. And the scriptures tell us that the waters of Mormon were beautiful to the eyes of them who there came to the knowledge of their Redeemer. The waters of Mormon have been, in my life, places like that youth conference. They've been moments in my home. There have been moments at church. They've been the chapel where I was tutored as a child in New York. They are every place that I have come to the knowledge of my Redeemer, and where I've been able to share my story and my burdens with those around me. And my Zion is those literal and virtual places as well, where covenants to love, to support, and to bear one another's burdens are being honored unrestrainedly and joyously. But the thing about that Zion is that it needs to be a reciprocal embrace. The thing about loyalty is that it needs to be returned in order to be deserved and fostered and garnered. We are the ones who are creating the circle that will envelop others. We are the ones who are creating a circle that will envelop and bring comfort to even the very most different member of this church. The connection is reciprocal. The embrace is only wide enough if we ourselves add to the outstretched arms of the circle. And it is only strong if we feel we can fall into the arms of others. We as a people are in the process of learning how to connect virtually today, how to show loyalty to each other virtually today. And apart from the physical proximity that defined most Zion communities in the past, we are breaking new ground. This is difficult work we are engaged in. We are testing our cell towers and our fiber cable's ability to gather us in spirit rather than body. We have work to do, and it's so heartening to see each person in this room today. And I hope that you will be committed to being a part of that good work. But I am confident that our drive to embrace and be embraced will lead us to a place where each one of us can feel the beauty of the gospel resonate throughout whatever context we may be most comfortable and most willing to receive it. And I think if we do that, it will lead us one day to a place that is beautiful to our eyes, even if that place is as impalpable as the angels that will surround us as we are able to create our own personal waters of Mormon and show loyalty to those gathered around there with us. Thank you very much for having me today. I would love to answer any questions that you have about my work with the women in the church, with the Mormon Women Project, with the book Women at Church, or anything else that you would love to discuss. I know this is a group that has lots of thoughts and experiences in these realms, so if I can be of a resource to you, please let me know.
Heads out back to Salt Lake City. So I've got the mic. If anyone has a question?
My question for you is about the website that you have, and you specifically use the word ministry. And what has been the response to the use of that word in the context of women? I can tell you what I've seen people, like how people have responded to me when I've heard that. And it's kind of like, what does that word mean? Like, why are you using that word? That's what I get from a lot of people. So I want to pass that on to you.
I love the idea in Catholicism, specifically about the idea of a vocation or some sort of personal calling that we discover for ourselves. And we don't really have a term for that as much in Mormonism. And in the discussion of sort of broadening the context of women's experiences to include those both-and models instead of those either-or models, it seemed like a very useful term or a very useful concept to bring into Mormonism. I think it actually is a useful tool for women to feel like they actually have something that allows them to be personally called to a particular path. And really the only rhetorical term we have for that in Mormonism is the idea of motherhood and a woman being called to be a mother. And that is both, an innate destiny and also something we are conditioned to do. So I wanted to provide a term that kind of opened up the possibilities of our innate destinies to something broader. And I felt that that ministry sort of embraced the best of our spiritual capabilities while also having a very sort of practical vocational element to it. It's a working word. It's a very active word. It's a word that suggests that we're engaged with those people that we're serving. And, I'm trying to coin a word or have a word enter our rhetoric, which may or may not be a successful experiment. We'll see. But I love the word, and I do hope that we start using it more in the context of women's expanded opportunities. Also, to give a little bit more context about that, I first kind of started exploring the word in the sense of our cooperative ministry, which is the full phrase of one of my online efforts, our cooperative ministry. And the term cooperative ministry came out of a talk that I gave in 2012 to the FAIR conference, which is an apologetic group to whom I was just introducing the idea that not all women in church are feeling a context that in which they can be themselves, and in which their potential is fully appreciated. And so I wanted to use words also, again, that suggested men and women working together, but that also, which I thought was going to be a concept that was very comfortable for this particular group, but I also wanted to push the envelope just a little bit and introduce this new idea that actually women have their own unique callings, their own unique spiritual callings, or their own ministries, their own avenues of service and development that they may be personally and individually called to. So, so again, I chose that word. But like I said, we'll see if we'll see if it actually picks up in common parlance. But for me, it holds a lot of the truth of what I'm trying to reach towards for our women. I mean, I would love to ask the group a question. Has anyone had a personal experience with this idea of loyalty? Has there ever been an experience that actually you've had to struggle with someone who perhaps didn't agree with you on a particular point, where loyalty sort of was able to trump all and result in some sort of peaceful or happy conclusion? Is there anything that you have felt that's really come to the fore of your testimony that's really helped you keep your eye on the beauty of the gospel rather than perhaps those things that can divide us? Yes.
We have a fellow in our congregation who doesn't fit the mold at all. And he's been a fixture in our work for many, many years. He's a recovering drug addict, and he is 300 pounds, and he has the voice of a baritone bass singer. He's just very loud and has some very challenging aspects to his personality, but I think that he's been a great blessing to our work in the sense that we have come to adapt our expectations and our understanding of what it means to be a disciple of Christ by allowing him to express those aspects in his character and us being receptive and welcoming to him. And it's been challenging for many of the members of the work, but I think it's been a good thing for us.
Would you be able to say what some of the tools that the members of the ward have relied on to actually make it possible to maintain a whole community?
Well, I think in terms of gifts, I think attributes or characteristics of Christ are patience, forgiveness, love. These things are all fine gifts, I think, that have been stretched and strengthened in the process of working with this man.
I think sometimes the actual, we believe so firmly in these principles, but sometimes it's fascinating to actually see in practice how they are implemented in a particular situation. Moving from belief into action can sometimes be that hardest part, and I think I'm sure each one of us has had an experience where we want it to be different than we actually are. What ultimately ends up persuading us and actually changing our behavior in a way that we know is right? Those factors vary for each of us. Sometimes, a lot in the church rhetoric, a lot of our leaders are talking about true conversion, believing that true conversion is the only catalyst we need to actually make our behavior match up with our professed beliefs. But I think that's a very complicated subject when we are faced with someone or something that has the potential to divide us. You know, what is it that motivates us to actually act on our beliefs? It's not as easy as it sounds, is it? But for each one of us, I think part of that it's a lesson that each one of us needs to learn about. What is it that motivates us individually to actually act on our beliefs? I don't think that there's a common recipe that is foolproof for each of us. Thank you. Yes?
I just was going to ask a question. When you said loyalty, though, I found myself kind of cringing. Like, to me, that, I don't know if I'm the only one, but, like, it has a negative connotation to me now after experiencing sort of the out-group part of loyalty. So how can someone like me who has, sort of been ostracized from the group for these out-group, in-group behaviors reconcile this idea that loyalty is a good thing? So you were saying, loyalty, it needs to be one of the main things that brings us together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I would go back to... I can understand that if you have not had loyalty practice towards you, it would be extremely, doubly, triply hard to actually reflect it back to somebody else. I go to my experience with my children again, and the things we've tried in order to teach that continual emphasis on loyalty, we actually have a pattern of language that we use. And again, I'm just kind of learning this for the first time because I didn't have any siblings. So I've tried to pick up the best that I can from other families I've seen. And my girls always have to say, "I feel blank because you did blank." And it's such a simple thing, but what it does is it forces them to actually look each other in the eye and express their own personal truth, the way they experienced whatever it was that went down between them. And I wish that I had been better trained to do this myself when I was young, because sometimes it's hard for me to stand up for myself in the face of some opposition and say, "I feel hurt because," or "I feel ostracized because," or "I feel misunderstood because you did this." It's an incredibly brave and difficult thing to do. And I am in awe of any grown-up or child who does it. But I think it goes back to the idea that it is through a pattern like that, and it's through an action like that, that we open the door to tell our own story, right? And again, I've seen miracles worked through telling our own personal stories. I have understood women who seem to be stonewalling me at every turn better when I learn of their personal experience. I have gained a tremendous amount of empathy doing interviews of women who have been hurt by and left the church because I am privy to their personal story. And so while I don't have a panacea for all of us, I think that being the first to perhaps ask another person for their story, or opening that two-way reciprocal communication that I was talking about, may be a way to heal some of those wounds. Because I know that they are real, I know that they are deep, but I also know it takes a lot of courage to be that person who says, "I am hurt because..." But by asking for another story, we earn the right to tell our own. And a lot of times, we can create a bond that no amount of data or online commenting can ever create.
So, I really admire your project. I think you're doing, you're really doing a lot of reaching out to women and telling these stories. Question I have, what concept, to what extent does it reflect back? So if a woman says, for instance, "I believe that women should be ordained to the priesthood," and then we go outside to convey this idea, "but I've been church member my entire life. I've been active. I support this gospel. Does she get loyalty in return from the institution? And I guess some people feel like they don't get loyalty in return. Like as soon as they say something that isn't party line, that they're cast out. And that's not a loyalty story. It's a one-way loyalty story. And that troubles me.
Well, I think the great enemy of loyalty is probably fear, right? The instinct to retrench in the face of some opposition it's an instinct of fear. It's an instinct that, you know, if I respond positively to this thing that is so other and that is so outside of what I have been taught is acceptable, then it will reflect back on me. Either it will change me or it will cause other people to judge me in a certain way. I think that in some ways that fear is prompted a lot by our commitment to this idea that if we obey the commandments, we are going to be happy now, here. And sometimes if we are obeying the commandments and we're not happy, that can create a very shallow foundation where fear can creep in very easily. And if we see somebody not obeying the commandments and being happy or taking some sort of alternative view and finding happiness in it, then that can be extremely destabilizing to our whole foundation, right, of what it means to be an acceptable offering before the Lord. And so across the spectrum of Mormon commitment, the commitment to loyalty is on the flip side and rooting out of fear. It is expressed, I think, you know, the byproduct of all of that is judgment. But I think what I am encouraging us to do is step back from that byproduct of judgment and actually look at the root of it, which is, I think, a sense of loyalty to common principles and to foundational beliefs, void of any of that fear that makes us feel like we're less than somebody else. Yes.
As far as Mormonism goes, what do you think is the difference between obedience and loyalty, or do you think there is a difference at all? Do you think they're like?
I think they're very different. Okay. Yeah, I think they're very different. I think loyalty is, as I said earlier, I think the antithesis of the opposite of obedience is this agency, right? Both divine, both incredibly important principles that make the world go around. I don't think loyalty in any way is the absence of agency. I think it is, in fact, choosing to focus on those things that bring us together, those things that we have in common, rather than to let those things divide us. And so I think when we're looking at the obedience versus agency framework, loyalty allows us to step above that and say, you know, we can fall on different places in that spectrum. Some of us may find more stability, more authenticity in obedience, and some of us may find those things more in expressing broader ranges of agency. But the loyalty is not to what side you're on. The loyalty is to that shared commitment of being a community together and celebrating the fact that each one of us in those diverse representations along that spectrum are representing divine truths, really. That agency and obedience are both beloved by God and both necessary in order for us to have this earthly experience. Yes?
Last question.
I love your philosophy about stories, and I'd love for you to speak about us trying to tell our own stories and delve into the questions that help us to get to the juice and the meat of our personal stories. How can we
go through that process on our own or maybe with a partner to find all that goodness that we have within ourselves?
That's a great question. I mean, for me personally, one of the most revolutionary things about the internet is the idea of self-publishing. I mean, the idea that people's journals that have been kept in boxes and in personal libraries can now be public. You know, sometimes we wish that they wouldn't make them so public. But usually it's an incredible, I think it really has been a divine tool to allow us to enjoy sort of globalization of the world and the huge challenges that come with our global community today, I think, have been balanced out and by this ability to get into each individual's life through a blog or through, you know, this proliferation of self-publishing. I absolutely love that context, that concept, and I hope that each one of us is taking advantage of it in some way. We may still be most comfortable with private journal keeping. And that is, you know, fantastic. But actually writing those stories down and recording them in some way for some sort of audience, I think is a really crucial exercise. I remember Claudia Bushman once said that she thinks that we should each write for an audience. And I stopped and I thought, well, that's a very strange idea, because a lot of my journal writing has been very cathartic sort of through the years. It's been very private, very cathartic. But I think, and I think there's a place for that, but I think that it's also crucial in this complex global world that we're in to represent our individual universes, to represent the story that is uniquely ours. And you can do that so easily today. I mean, it takes discipline, whether you decide to do that, you know, in one sitting every year, or whether you decide to do it once a day or once a week. You know, you have to set aside the time. It takes that discipline to do it. But you can either do it privately, or you can seek out somebody like me. You can seek out a rising number of sites and organizations that are collecting world histories. And you know, offer to tell me your story. It takes a lot of confidence for a woman to actually, you know, agree to tell me her story. And I will approach women sometimes, and I'll learn a little about them, and say, "Oh, I'd love for you to tell me your story." And 9 times out of 10, they'll say, "Oh, you know, I don't need to share. There's nothing unique about my story." And if I've learned anything from doing 5 years of this, it is that every single person has a story. It is the framework of every emotion and response that you have. It's those experiences that have been built up over time to formulate who you are. And you know, for me personally, there's nothing more gratifying than sitting down with a Mormon woman and unpacking what it is that has gotten her to that point in her life. Sometimes it is, you know, well, I thought I should get married early on, I thought I should start having children. And looking at the influences that actually led her in a very stereotypical path are just as fascinating to me as that woman who said, "Oh, I wasn't interested in any of that, and I went and I traveled around until I was 30, and, you know, then, only then thought about getting married." But regardless of that path, those motivations are really the tools for helping us take that empathetic stance towards each other. So the more we can share those stories, the more we can read those stories, I think, again, is really the key to creating that sense of loyalty, or you can just call it for sheer love of each woman, understanding, you know, the challenges that she had to overcome, understanding where we're catching her at that particular snapshot in her life. You know, what is she going to do tomorrow morning after we've left interviewing her? How is she going in the next 5, 10 years of her life to respond to the pressures that we see in her life today in this small snapshot? All of that is endlessly fascinating to me, and I think is really what makes love and loyalty possible. Thank you. Thank you.
just give one big round of applause? And if you haven't already, I would just encourage you to buy her book, Women at Church. You can find it, it's at Ezra Book, and it's online. And I'm sure it's on Amazon, right? Yeah, and maybe if you are active, you can spread it, give it out as a ward neighborhood Christmas present. So, thanks everyone again for coming. I want to say something really more than like, we've all been spiritually fed today, which is true, but really I just want to thank everyone for coming. It means a lot to me personally, and it was so great to get together with everyone. Again, we're going to email you a survey, and so please take it. The feedback is really, really important. And I don't know if anyone is planning on coming in your bags. There's an advertisement for the Singles in the Borderlands. That's actually being moved to the 20th because Elna Baker, our speaker, has an HBO audition. So that's going to move to the 20th. And I would just encourage everyone to subscribe to Sunstone Magazine. If you guys value Sunstone, we need your continued support. So you can make a donation or subscribe to the magazine. And again, I just want to say a big special thank you to all the presenters who came here. Can we give them another round of applause? And another big, huge, special thank you to the Community of Christ, who was so generous with their space. I mean, the Community of Christ are amazing. And they have a drum set in there. Is there is an after party at the Browns. The Browns are generously hosting it in their Posh Seattle loft. And the address is right here on the back. And you are welcome to bring something and hang out and not stay too late because I have to go to bed to be in Portland. So if you want to end up in Portland, you want to come follow us in Portland. We're going to be doing a quilting service project for LGBT youth who have been displaced from their Mormon homes. So we're going to be quilting while we hear the words. And King's going to make an announcement. And then we're going to have a closing prayer by Chris Sargent, who is the pastor. Pastor, right? I always get the lingo a little messed up of this congregation.
I just want to take a moment to say what we're probably all thinking, which is a huge thank you to our Dr. Pepperfield Dynamo, who put this conference together. If you haven't already, you can listen to her on the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast and basically every other podcast in the Mormon universe. You can read her writing at Feminist Mormon Housewives. She's all over Facebook. She is brilliant, tireless, and the person who has put this together and is putting together 1,000 other events that you can see when you open up your program. So we're just really happy at Sunstone that Lindsay is a part of our community. And seriously, you know, sign me up for the Church of Lindsay. This is the place. So, yay, Lindsay.
First of all, I would just like to thank, to let you know how pleased that we at the Rainier Valley Community of Christ Church have been to welcome you into our building and to share the day's activities with you. It's been very special. Will you pray with me, please? Creator God, we have come today, some of us with concerns, some of us with fears, some of us with anxieties, and some of us with sorrows. We have also come with joys, and we have come with faith. We have come with a desire to draw close to you and to draw close to one another. We thank you for this community, which has provided an opportunity for us to share our thoughts, to ask our questions, and to listen to those concerns and those ideas that others share. Lord, we know that each of us has been created by you with intelligence, with a desire to serve you, and that we have been blessed with gifts and talents that are unique and specific to each of us. And we know that you empower us in ways that help us to expand the potential that you have created in us. And so, Lord, as we leave this gathering, it is my prayer that we might move out in faith with a renewed desire to serve you in all that we do. I ask this in the name of Jesus Christ, our Savior. Amen.